You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
Hey, it's Brother One.
And Brother Two.
From Two Brothers Mattress. You'll spend 33% of this year on your mattress. That's almost 3,000 hours. Start sleeping comfortably now on a new Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
With our lowest price guarantee
and our 100-night trial,
your locally owned Two Brothers mattress is your number one choice for Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
Twobrothersmattress.com.
This episode of Mode Push, a much-anticipated episode, as Dan is in Sydney, Australia, prepping to go to the Singapore GP this weekend. We'll get the breakdown of whether or not Max Verstappen can get the world championship all tied up, what has to happen for that, plus some of the differences between an F1 car and a NASCAR. Dan has been familiar with both of those, so we're going to break all that down right now on Mode Push.
Radio check.
Loud and clear.
KSL Sports and KSL Podcast present Mode Push, an American view of F1, starting now.
One stop. Here's what you get with this Odyssey.
I'm gutted. I'm absolutely gutted.
I enjoyed this so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Everybody, welcome in. It's another edition of Mode Push, our F1 podcast brought to you by KSL Sports and KSL Podcast. Alex Keery here, stateside. Dan Jimenez, our own Dan Jimenez, reporting for us across the world. Doing work, of course, actual work for his actual job, and then his hobby on the side. Doing this podcast and, of course, covering the race this weekend in Singapore. When I say covering it, I think it's a little bit too late to get a media pass. And you don't want a media pass, Dan. You want to actually, like, enjoy it as a fan because this is your first time, man.
Yeah, I want the full fan experience. So I want to be up there with the commoners in the grandstands.
I'll tell you right now, they treat fans way better at events than they do media anyway. I mean, just having covered things as media, like, you're looked at sideways. If you can't cheer, you can't be excited. You got to just – you got to be a stick in the mud – and pretend like you have no emotions, and that's how you come across as a media person, and that's how you're treated too. So it's better that you're going to have this experience this way. So Dan is currently — you're in Sydney, Australia, yes? And so
that's right.
Please run down for us, because you've snuck in some things on this trip that is even prior to going to Singapore that is kind of an F1. I guess a person who's an F1 fan would really, really appreciate. What have you been doing?
Yeah, aside from kangaroo hunting, we've been able to do a few F1-related things. So we were in Melbourne for a few days, and just casually at dinner, one of our kind of partners down there in Australia asked if we had driven the F1 track. And I was like, wait, is that a possibility?
Can you do that? I mean,
and they're like, oh, yeah, it's just in a park. And I was like, oh, so Albert Park is an actual park. It's not like just the name for a road race course, because when you watch the Melbourne Grand Prix or the Australian GP, it looks like a full professional race course.
Right.
It does not look like a street circuit, right? And so we drove down there, and it was already dark, but it's like a central park. Like, think of Central Park in New York City. It's a big city center metro park that they convert into a racetrack once a year. And you can, as we were driving in, we realized we were all of a sudden on really, really smooth asphalt.
Like, with some stripes.
Very different from
with,
the rest.
Sausage curbs, yeah, on the side and stripes on the side, yeah.
Yeah. What was interesting is there weren't any sausage curbs. There was no other indicators that it was a racetrack other than it was really smooth. And then when we found our way to the front stretch, then you see the paddock area. So you see all the garages.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the front stretch was essentially a parking lot. And there were people parked up and down the front stretch, because above the garages on the second level of the paddock were like indoor soccer, indoor basketball facilities. And there were just people out there playing rec basketball and soccer above the F1 garages, which I thought was really interesting. And then they've painted over the start boxes, but you can kind of see the start boxes like where the grid would be.
They don't want everybody stopping. They don't want everybody stopping and doing their own start-stop practices. That's against the rules.
That's right. Yeah, they actually have like big cones set up so that you have to really slow down before you get into that area. And then the one thing that they have left is the start finish line is painted still. So we got out of the car, we took pictures with the start finish line.
Oh, that's cool.
And then we drove the course, and there's signs everywhere that say, you know, being actively monitored by speed cameras and all that stuff. And so we tried to keep it within the speed limit, but it was really fun to drive the course. Like, okay, this is turn one, this is turn two, this is, you know, where the DRS is. It was a lot of fun. We did a couple laps around.
What was the rental car that you pushed to the limit, I'm assuming then?
Yeah, we were in
like a Fiat Duna,
a Mitsubishi. We were in a Mitsubishi something. Yeah,
that's the old Mitsubishi power unit. Yeah. No, I know.
Yeah.
speed cameras, because I'm assuming people go there and they go, dude, I was at Albert Park and I did 140 miles an hour at Albert Park too.
Right. Yeah. And even when we drove out to some of the other sightseeing things, we did way out in the bush and out to the kind of coast area, we were like, oh, well, you know, like in the U.S., speed limits are kind of more suggestions. And so we were, I don't know, maybe if I can't indict myself here, but we were doing a relative amount to the speed limit that you'd used to be doing in the U.S. And then when we talked to our Aussie friends and we asked them, so how often do you guys break the speed limit? They looked at us. They're like, very rarely.
Right.
So like, I'm just waiting to see what's going to be in my mailbox back in the U.S. when I get home waiting for me.
I've actually had that before. Have you ever gotten the by mail ticket before? California was good at this for a long time. Like I got hit. It's the most embarrassing thing too. I cannot wait for the Dan Jimenez, like, it has a shot of the front and back of the Mitsubishi that you're flooring it in. And then your face, because like my thing is like the California
I'm just grinning.
One.
Yeah.
I rolled through a red light turning right one time. It's like, okay, yeah, the old appropriately named the California roll kind of through there. And I remember not thinking anything of it. And then like 2 weeks later, I get this thing in my mailbox, and it's like, hey, you owe $91 to the city of Anaheim, and here's your ugly mug. Ooh. Right? It shows me, and I look guilty. Like, it's not even that. I wasn't even looking at it. I didn't even know I got my picture taken. But I look as guilty as you could get. So that maybe we'll get a version of that when you come back. You'll have a couple of speeding tickets. I would be disappointed with no less than I think the over-under on speeding tickets then for you is probably 1.5. I'll take the
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be. I'll have to make that photo of my face my new Twitter avatar.
Oh my goodness, it would be classic to have you the speeding ticket at Albert Park. That it's almost like you need to do it. So
yeah.
All right, so
it's a commitment.
There's a race this weekend. This is what we've been waiting for. We've been getting through with some of these historical podcasts. We've been kind of informing people the history of F1 a little bit and kind of going through some of the engineering side of things. It's actual race week here. And so now a couple weeks off that these teams have had to get across the world and to hit the Singapore GP. What's the history of this race, this course, and maybe a little bit of what to expect and where this lands in like of the race weeks, where is it one of these courses that the drivers love? It's certainly any night race is really, really cool. I think it looks like that. That's a sexy sell. I think it's one of those that I can show my kids and go, that looks pretty darn cool. And those sparks are coming down. So where does this Singapore GP land in terms of the historical importance of it? And how much do the racing drivers love this?
Yeah, Singapore lands more on the newer side of the scale for kind of amount of historicity in the sport. I think it marks a new era for F1 where they really started thinking about new markets and being able to start these races in these time zones that are kind of on the other side of the world from where the majority of their fan base is. And then kind of leaning into the night race being one of the first night races F1 ever held in Singapore, I think is just part of kind of the cultural experimentation that F1 has been doing and trying to see what resonates with fans. And I think what they've found is that people love watching night races, both in person and on television, and are willing to, you know, get up at odd hours to be able to watch these. And then from how do the drivers look at it and the teams, it's a road course. And when I say that, it's like, these are the real streets that real, people are driving on day in and day out. And what that means is that they're very rough and compared to the kind of more purpose-built courses that they race on in Europe. And with that roughness in the streets, that really affects how teams are able to generate grip. And so you have to have a higher level of travel and built into the car to be able to take in all those bumps on the curbs and driving over manhole covers and whatever it may be. And so that increased amount of travel that you have to build into the car raises the car up, and you're producing a lot less downforce from sucking the car to the ground. And so teams that are able to produce a lot of downforce in slow corners are going to do well at Singapore. Teams that rely upon high downforce at high speeds, like Red Bull has been able to do this year, are going to have a little bit of a harder time. So there's people that are speculating, kind of predicting that Ferrari will actually have the best car for this particular type of course, generating grip at low speeds, because it's a lot of short bursts in between city blocks and then slow 90-degree corners and tight entrances, a lot like Baku. But one big difference between Singapore and Baku or Azerbaijan is that Azerbaijan has that super long front stretch that takes that makes up a majority or a big portion of the lap time. And so they still have to balance that aero and low downforce section of the track. But Singapore is just right turn after right turn. And so teams are going to be coming with high downforce setups to maximize at the slow speeds.
I was looking at, night races are, what do you have, what's on the circuit in terms of night races? I mean, the majority obviously are that 3 p.m., you know, local start time. But these night races are something that's really cool, I think. And it's one that there's going to be a U.S. night race, obviously, next year I was just looking at the Vegas map and trying to figure out where you and I could be staying next year in mid-November. I'm like, at the Bellagio, those are the ones that are already going to be taken, and that I can't just write off work trip.
We're like circus.
Well, no, look, yeah. Well, there's a Taco Bell right at turn 11, so I just figured maybe I could just hit the Taco Bell and go, oh, there's a race going through here. I didn't know that. I'll just be posted up here by the window. But the night race is interesting, and that's a newish thing as well, because historically, obviously, these cars don't have lights on them, and so you have to have a well-lit track all the way across. But it's a spectacle that I think that all of these places that have night races, I mean, there's a reason I think that you see some of these night races have, you see them used in so many of these cuts and highlights of F1, because it's just such a cool look.
Yeah, you get to see the sparks coming off the car. There's more of like a fireworks show as these cars bottom out at high speeds or on the street courses. Makes it really cool. Yeah, so you see the Middle Eastern, like Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. Qatar, Abu Dhabi, those are night races. I think that's predominantly done because of the heat. It's just so hot during the day that it would just cook these drivers and these cars. I think it's going to be really exciting. I'm glad Vegas is a night race as well. It's probably heat related that it's at night. Also, it's like a 1 a.m. start time in Vegas Eastern.
Oh, really?
And that was a lot of people. Yeah,
10 Pacific.
So it's a 10
right?
p.m.
Yeah.
10 Pacific. But it's, you know, there's just a lot of American fans are a little frustrated when they announce that schedule and they're like, wait, I got to stay up to midnight to watch this race in my own country. that's a little bit of a head scratcher. I'd like to see them maybe push that more towards a primetime slot for the U.S. in future years.
Interested to see how they do this, like just the logistics of it. I'm sure, look, Vegas pulls off crazy events. I mean, that's their thing. But this is different. I mean, this is and they have a racetrack there in Vegas, right? They have an actual, you know, NASCAR circuit race there outside of town. They've hosted massive things before. And so Vegas is no stranger to hosting big events, but something that stretches across, you know, the 4 miles around the strip is going to be quite interesting how they're going to handle that thing. And yeah, I want to see how we can actually go and watch this thing and how they're going to shut the streets down. Just shutting down the entire strip seems like a crazy thing. So let's get back to the race for this week and what to expect from the actual standpoint of the world championship. Max Verstappen can win the world championship this weekend. And I think that the flow charts that I've seen of how he could do it aren't actually that complicated, because we've seen this happen where he basically just needs to finish first. And then Ferrari needs to, you know, have technical failure. And then Max is the world champion this weekend, or is it a little bit more complicated than that?
Yeah, that's it. If Max wins and has the fastest lap, which he's done a lot recently, then Charles, if he finishes eighth or lower, then and then Sergio finishes fourth or lower, then that's Max's most clear way to locking up the championship this week. So, you know, there's not going to be a scenario that Charles finishes eighth or lower outside of, you know, a racing incident or a technical failure,
right?
Like you said. So I think if, you know, I expect Charles to win pole again this at Singapore this week and then get off to a clean start. And if I'm a betting man, I wouldn't say that Max locks it up this week. I think it'll continue on to, you know, further races into Suzuka and maybe further.
The weather forecast this week, and you're talking about how, you know, humid and muggy and hot Singapore is going to be already. But I think earlier in the week, at least, the forecast was a lot of rain. That's one of those things that can – rain is a variable in F1 that changes the race, and it actually makes it a lot of fun for people who are pretty new to the sport, where they go, oh, good, it mixes up the grid a little bit. You don't have just, like, the normal finishing, and it tends to be a little bit better than just, like, maybe that 40-second win that sometimes you see in these races and you're anticipating something better. So what's the forecast still looking like this weekend?
Yeah, it's still calling for hot temperatures and a high chance of rain. I will say that on this side of the world, about every day so far that I've been out here, it's called for rain, but the majority of the day has been sunny or not raining.
Right.
And the weather just moves through really fast here. And so maybe the same story in Singapore, that, you know, it's 100% chance of rain, but it's all contained within a couple of hours, and maybe that overlaps with the race or not. It's just really hard to predict. The other day I got woken up by a thunderstorm at 6 a.m. that was as strong as any thunderstorm I've ever been in. And I opened up the weather app and it didn't even show up yet. It was just a burst that came out of nowhere. So I think there's just a lot of variability that could surprise the teams, and the weather just shows up out of nowhere. And like you said, they say rain is the great equalizer when it comes to racing, because, you know, the speeds have to slow down. And so downforce becomes less of an advantage for the teams. And so that puts the cars more on equal basis. And then the drivers, those who have more experience in the rain, can get more out of their cars, will definitely pick up a lot of time. And then strategy, you know, switching between full wets to intermediate wets to dry tires, is a huge difference in lap time. And whoever can make that prediction, like we saw in races previously, I think last year in Russia was one of those examples, the Russian GP, where if, you know, you made that call to go to slicks a lap sooner than everybody else, you could make up, you know, 10, 15 seconds. And so there's a fun strategy element to the rain as well.
Looking at the rest of the calendar here, so we are looking at this one. Abu Dhabi is the last race. That's going to be November. So I'm counting up 4, 5, 6. Let me see. So there's 7 races left, including Singapore, right? So you got this race, Japan, yeah, the United States, Mexico, Brazil, Abu Dhabi. I guess that works out to be – that works out to be 6.
It's 6 with Singapore.
Yeah, 6 yeah. more races left. What are we looking for here? And I was thinking about this too, Dan, when we've talked about this year and just how interesting it was, because Max is really – he really can – it could turn into historically one of the greatest singular, like, driver seasons ever by a world champ, because he's on the cusp of breaking the single season win record total. And I think he could really do it. And it looks like he's probably going to do it. Is there going to be like some sort of an asterisk with this year where everybody's like, yeah, but that was that year that everybody got brand new regulations and no one could figure things out. And Red Bull was just ahead of the development game from everybody else. It wasn't necessarily the, I mean, how are we going to look at this year historically if Max does run away with this world championship and have the record winning amount of races in a season?
Yeah, I have not thought of this year as an asterisk year, because the engineer in me just wants to give all the credit to the Red Bull engineering team for having put together the best car. Like,
yeah,
you know, lots of regulation changes coming into the year, but everybody had the same rule book to follow. And, you know, credit where credit is due to Red Bull for engineering the best car out of the gate. And it'll take some time for everybody to catch up to him. So I don't think of it as an asterisk. You might be able to say, like, oh, Max just clearly had the better car, but you also don't see Checo, you know, running away with second place either. And so I think it's a combination of an incredibly designed car by Red Bull, and Max just, I think, being at the top of his game and the best driver on the circuit has created this stretch in the distance between first and second place on the grid. And so I don't think of it as like an asterisk, like you would the, you know, the NBA bubble year or, you know, anything else that we've seen in other sports. I think that full credit to the team that wins this year.
You're looking at all the teams and every week, every couple of weeks, and we certainly have had a couple of weeks off. When they do have a couple of weeks off, everybody looks and goes, okay, what's going on with these teams and these seats that are still up for grabs? Have we determined anything else going on here? I know that Christian Horner threw a bone to his former driver, Daniel Ricciardo, this week and said, if I'm Alpine, I'm basically the way that Christian Horner does it. I would be an idiot if I did not sign Daniel to a seat there, which Alpine's still looking to assign somebody for that 2023 seat, as Esteban Ocon really right now looks like the only guy who signed up. So what do we know about some of these other teams and the confirmed deals that have maybe happened or not over the last few weeks?
Yeah, it's so funny. I saw some meme yesterday, and it was that the meme of Spider-Man pointing to himself, and there's like six Spider-Mans around the circle, and it's like seven drivers trying to get three seats. Because we reported last week there were four available seats, but since then they've confirmed Zhou Guanyu and Alfa Romeo. So there's only three seats left: Williams, Alpine, and AlphaTauri. Mm-hmm. And so, and then Haas if they decide not to re-up Mick. So,
what's the deal though what's the deal with Pierre Gasly's contract at AlphaTauri though? Because his contract goes through I don't know when. I think the end of 2023. But they're like, yeah, except for it might not. Like, so is that just him backing out of it? And how does that work? I mean, you're looking at a guy that I think a lot of people look at and go, oh yeah, French. He's going to go to Alpine, but how is it that he just goes, yeah, I'm going to step out of this contract early?
Yeah, it is interesting that there's still so many rumors floating around him leaving when he extended his contract through 2023 this summer. And I think that speculation is driven by, what's at Alpine and what, AlphaTauri might see as a possible replacement. I think that if he's not happy there, then I think they could come to some sort of amicable agreement on the contract. But you think that he wouldn't have re-upped for another year if he wasn't happy. So it's weird. Like when you look at the graphics, they all say that, you know, he's locked in for next year, but then so many Twitter rumors fly around that he still may be on the move with the Alpine seat open. So it's kind of a wait and see, but you know, it would surprise me if he stays there another year and waits for some more open seats for something better next year. And then on the Daniel Ricciardo piece, if Christian Horner's right, if I'm at AlphaTauri, that would be, or even Alpine, I would be thinking that Daniel Ricciardo's by far and away the best talent on the grid, but maybe that's not what Daniel Ricciardo wants. And he wants to wait an extra year. And there's rumors this week of Daniel Ricciardo doing a year in NASCAR here in the U.S. with the Project 91 team, which is a relatively very new team. To NASCAR. That's the team that Kimi Raikkonen ran the Charlotte race earlier, I think it was a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. And their Project 91 is all about trying to get talent from other sports, specifically F1, to get them into NASCAR. And that would be a dream for them to get Daniel Ricciardo. He already resonates so well with U.S. fans here. Kimi Raikkonen did a similar year after his F1 championship in the Truck Series. And that was always entertaining to watch, just the culture clash between Kimi and all the Southern good old boys on the truck racing circuit. And so I think that Daniel could be a really big personality in NASCAR. And that Project 91 team is really new. So I don't know how competitive they would be, but maybe that's a possibility for him if he doesn't do the Mercedes reserve driver thing for a year.
That's when Kyle Busch rolls up to Kimi's, the side of his window when he's pissed about something. And that's like you don't want to mess with the Iceman. Listen, if there's going to be a fight in the truck circuit, like the Busch, Kyle Busch can't just run up and throw his helmet at Kimi Raikkonen. Kimi Raikkonen will lay down the law.
Nobody.
Like, so.
That's right. Yeah. The best was when there was a whole race where Kimi Raikkonen spent the whole race complaining about his drink bottle. not working correctly.
You give me the Where's warm the water. Drink? You give me the warm water. The kid doesn't even come out. It's warm.
Yeah. The Kimi Raikkonen radio messages are classic. Somebody did ask me this week, Dan, and you can help answer this because I'm always just like, nah, I'm going to defer to Dan on these questions as always. Aside from the cars looking different and the tracks looking different, what are the big differences between a NASCAR, like NASCAR race cars and F1 cars? And because, you know, the NASCAR's top speed are right up there with the F1 cars, you know, top speed. But what are the big differences if somebody's getting into Formula One racing, that the differences between these cars and a NASCAR that's flying around a big oval?
Yeah, so NASCAR, the whole premise behind that was the couplet of win on Sunday, sell on Monday. So they're trying to really promote the brands and the specific vehicle models that are out on the track. And originally that was the case. Like, you'd have the, you know, Plymouth Superbird out there that Richard Petty's driving around, and that's literally the car you could go buy from the dealership. And then over the years, they got more purpose built. So they had very little in common with the street cars that Ford and Chevy and Toyota are trying to sell. But that's basically the premise. They're big, they're heavy when it comes by race car standards. They operate mostly in a relatively narrow speed band between their low speed and their high speed on the ovals, high banking, and with the not being open wheel, being closed wheel, they can bang on each other. They can hit each other. They can get all mangled and keep on racing. And so that's more of the big difference there from F1 and other open wheel, which is trying to maximize the engineering potential of these cars to go as fast as possible. So they're super light. They have a bit more advanced suspensions and obviously the downforce and all of the advanced technology that they have is a lot higher, but that's because the cost caps or the budgets for these teams are a lot different. And you got 20 cars, but 10 teams in making up F1, and you've got, you know, 43 or 40 cars in NASCAR by, you know, between 28 different teams. And so it's just, the budgets are smaller there. But if you're the casual fan, I think that, you know, maybe not having watched motorsports first, you'll find F1 more visually appealing, just the different places that they go, the different culture, the tracks are more interesting. And with NASCAR, it's more about like the direct competition between the different drivers, right. And, you know, allowing those drivers to get a bit more physical with their cars and, you know, sometimes with their fists. So it just appeals to a different type of fan.
What power plant wise, like what's the,
yeah.
Like, what are we looking at here? Like difference wise? I mean, you know, the difference of the cars is, you have that rear wheel drive, super heavy stock car that will slide all over the place and doesn't really rely on that downforce like you were talking about. But I mean, in terms of like how much horsepower they're working with, I know that F1 is big deal is, hey, look what we're doing. We're doing a hybrid engine. We're trying to be responsible with this F or, you know, NASCAR is more like FU F1. Like, we're just going to have big old cars with big old engines. They haven't had the
displacement.
Know, right.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember we were getting like 4 miles to the gallon, 3 miles to the gallon.
That's pretty good.
And you're refilling, you know, three or four times a race. But so NASCAR, you know, big block V8s, huge displacement, and, you know, 5 liters plus. And they're making, I mean, when I was there, we were making, they keep the horsepower numbers under lock and key, but it was pretty common to have anywhere between 700 and 800 horse. So a lot of power. But relatively low RPMs. So big displacement, low RPMs, running kind of maxing out around 9,000 RPMs, where F1 is really small displacement, like 1.6 liters, I think, is what the current displacement rule is. And like 20,000 RPM, 19,000 RPM.
Right.
It's absolutely incredible what the F1 engines are able to turn. And what that means is just the torque that they're able to produce. So they're able to get a lot of power and torque. And again, I think the horsepower numbers are pretty private, but from what I've read, they're getting back up to the 900 to 1,000 horsepower range on the F1 cars now. With each iteration of the engine regulations in F1 over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, they've been progressively going into smaller displacement, higher RPMs, and then adding on the hybrid power.
So
and
what
that 1,000 RPM is including the hybrid power too.
What has to be like? What has to be the same across the teams in F1? Like the 1.6 liter hybrid engines. But what are the things like? What are the pieces of technology that basically have to be the same, or are these power units essentially different aside from some of the displacement numbers?
Yeah, and we could maybe go into a deeper dive with that on a separate episode, and I could do a bit more research. But from what I know, obviously the displacement, there's going to be a lot that has to be similar. And then the this year, there's the two hybrid engines that, or I guess, no, they got rid of the other hybrid engines. So there's been the kinetic and then the heat hybrid transfer engines or motors. And they're going to be, you know, simplifying those down. And so that's all common between everybody.
Yeah.
There is still a fair amount of ingenuity that goes into all of this and the development. And I mean, developing the motor is as, you know, technologically intensive and, you know, resource intensive as developing the car.
Yeah.
So that's why you see these, you know, different teams partnering to get power from, you know, the main engine builders, which are, you know, Ferrari, Mercedes, Renault. And then Red Bull making their own engines.
Okay, how's this one work out this weekend? You're going to be you. When do you go up to Singapore, and what does your weekend look like here before we get out here?
Yeah, Friday morning, take off from Sydney, land in Singapore, do a business visit, and then we're going to head to FP2 in the evening, and then FP3 and qualifying on Saturday. And then the race on Sunday, and there's a lot going on. They've got concerts. I think there's a Green Day concert. There's a Black Eyed Peas concert. So we're going to hang around for that stuff, get a ride on the Ferris wheel. I just don't know really what to expect other than I know where we need to be at what time for the different events. There's also two support races that are happening this weekend in Singapore. There is a all women's single seater racing series. So think F1 cars, open wheel, but it's all women, 20 women on the grid. And I think this is like their 10th race or something, the first time coming to Singapore. So I want to go see that. And then there's also a professional kind of sports car GT3 GTM series from Thailand. That's like apparently their premier series that's going to be racing on the streets too. So that'll be cool to go out there and see like some, you know, BMWs and, you know, Lamborghinis and stuff racing each other.
Well, it's an exciting weekend for you. The rest of us are going to be I'm going to be time shift watching it like I do everything else in my life. And it's a full weekend of college football and professional football. And then I'll be looking for you in the – I don't know. What am I supposed to do? Find yourself – they have so many shots, F1 shots. Please find yourself on a camera. I'm going to be like meticulously going over. And are you going to have your your face painted red with the Ferrari yellow on it? Like how am I supposed to spot you?
Well, I'll figure something out. But yeah, turn one, just right there in the stands about 8 rows up.
Okay.
So I'll find a way to – big old sign that says, hi, Alex.
All right, perfect. And then we'll get the breakdown of the race as well because we'll have to do that. That turnaround is going to be quick too. I don't know how we're going to pull Sunday off because you're going to have to figure it out. And
I think we're all in on an all-nighter. I think we're going to do an all-nighter because we've got a early morning takeoff the next day. So we'll figure it out.
And you can sleep for the next 2 weeks anyway when you come home. Your kids don't need to see you. It's fine.
Right. Yeah.
All right, Dan. We appreciate it, and my heavens, I'm super. The jealousy level is through the roof at this point, and I think that anybody who's joining our show maybe for the first time, they'll be enjoying it as well. So, have fun, stay safe, and safe travels. Still, we get there all intact, so we can watch this race, man.
Will do. Thank you so much.
All right, for Dan Jimenez, Alex Keery, this has been F1 Mode Push right here at KSL Podcast, KSL Sports. We'll talk to you after the Singapore GP. We'll get the breakdown there from Dan from Singapore. So for Dan, I'm Alex. We'll see you next time, everybody.